Welcome to a podcast of The Business of Authoring, presented by Marcia Huber, Charles Williams, and Robert Christofferson. This podcast was recorded at the 2010 Text and Academic Authors Association Conference in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
My name is Robert Christofferson, Charles Williams, Marcia Huber. By treating it like a business, I mean that you have text-specific business cards, a text-specific letterhead. Now, it can say, mine says author teacher. I was a professor for 30 years. I could put that on there too. But a specific card, because you're a business. You're not a university. And your business card, Ann Bobaze is on here too, as production assistant photographer, although she has her own cards. We went and got a P.O. box that's text specific. The phone number is a cell phone that is only used for that purpose, the 390 number. And it's got the email on there and the website. The reason for this is at national sales meetings, you can put, could you turn on, just hit those two, one of those two switches, or both of them. You put the business card in the booth so that when the people are coming by, there's the author's business card. When somebody talks to you in the booth or you're walking in the hall and someone stops you, you hand them a card. They put that in their wallet, put that in their pocket. They may never call, but there's a contact. He gave me a card. And I found this to be critical communicating with adopters and students. A student with one of those cards in their hand is just worth everything. They just beam. They are so thrilled. So I would suggest that if you have not done that already. I do apologize for all of the obvious things I might be saying that you're all already doing. But these are just my idea. Secondly, the idea of preparing your home office and writing studio as if it's a formal business. Now, we do a lot of electronic PDF stuff now, but I still find a full-service copy machine is really valuable, especially for developing art where you can enlarge and reduce and mess with art with the fax built in. We still use fax now and then to transmit things rapidly, offsetting, converting it to a PDF kind of a thing. For years, we would buy second-hand or reinvigorated copy machines at a discount, put them on our tax depreciation schedule, or write it all off on one year. But that, to me, has saved more miles, more time, more effort to have a full-scale copy machine there. And secondly, the headset. Maybe all of you already have headsets. Well, I won't ask for a show of hands, but Karen agree. Have a headset for those long teleconferences and calls with editors and whatever else. To have your hands free is critical, and you can just set the phone in your pocket or clip it to your belt, and your hands are free to work. So these are just little things, but I think that's part of this authoring as a business. We took my writing studio and had a cabinet maker just built in the whole thing. So it is a thoroughly dedicated room. It has full desk on three walls. And in the corner there where... So the space isn't lost. There's a 36-inch Lazy Susan under there that has more supplies on it and things like that. So this is a dedicated room. If we still had children at home or family, that it would signal to everyone that I was a serious author and that was Pop's business and this is what he's doing. This isn't a card table in the garage or dining room table type of thing. But this this locks it in as an IRS audit-proof facility used for one sole purpose. Having the bookcases elevated, other than the other room that has the library in it, elevated allows you to have the corkboard under there, and I found it's really good to have a large corkboard 14 feet long here that I can tag things on, whereas if the bookcases went all the way to the floor, I'd lose that space. But again, I apologize for whatever obviousness I'm saying here. Around the computer, I designed and had these guys build like a big theater organ console. so that the computer screen is surrounded by this workspace area where things can be posted and set. And if I work on big broadsheets a lot of time, and I'll put the broadsheets up and then the space for the monitor. And I would recommend the full 30-inch Apple Cinema monitor, because if you're writing, there are at least six documents I can think of that should be open simultaneously all at once, like the glossary document, your new features document, talking points document, the table of content outline document of H1, H2, H3 heads, the text document itself, plus your browser. And all those should be open at once, and doing those on 14 or 17 inch, it's just too small. And the large Apple Cinema, prices are coming down. It's a write-off. I found the flat panel is much easier on the eyes than the CRT monitors and all of that. But it's just a suggestion. So you've got it surrounded in a workable space. The ergodynamics work better that way. And storage underneath and stuff. The little lip here allows you two areas where you can prop things up stacked like that. And that's a look at the console head on. Now, some of the rest of you comment on how do you have your work area designed around the monitor. Any comments to add? Because this is just one person's view. This isn't the right or wrong way to do it. That's just me.
Have you thought about going to a two-monitor system? I know that will.
I'm that close, and I'm trying to figure out how to put the other one on, but that's excellent.
Well, I don't have the 30-inch, I've got smaller.
Yeah. For some static items that need ready reference. Yeah.
I have three monitors. I love it so much, and it's really not difficult.
Yeah.
And boy, I'm glad I did it, because you don't have to overlap any of those windows.
The National Weather Service would call that an AWIPS display, AWIPS. They use three monitors. Yeah, Paul?
On the two monitor, when I went to it, I found out that the two have to be the same size. Now, when you go to three, is that the coefficient the same thing? They must be the same size monitors.
Otherwise, because you need two for standard computer measurements. So I
Okay. Well, let's move on. The other thing, too, is the preparation file. I have a hanging folder or a folder for every H1, H2, and H3 head. So during the time of the book, that's like a master file, and your preparation file for the next edition can be derived from that. I think lateral filing cabinets save a lot of space. In terms of business ideas, my textbooks are Earth System Science Physical Geography. So that means almost every time we step out of the house, we're doing business. We keep a detailed travel log of stop and start mileage and a description of what we did. That includes to and from the FedEx drop. We measured the mileage exactly, and the number of miles to and from we put on our business miles log. And writing conferences like TAA, that's part of the business. This is a business operation, a business practice. Marshall will talk more about this. Start making photographs for your own book. Get a digital camera and start cutting into that photo research part of your book project. You're the best one to know what a good chapter opener is. And get it. You don't have to be a professional, and get a camera and get a tripod and start doing everyday photos to fit into the book. That is more going into the business and enlarging the tax footprint. Equipment purchases and office expenses, office supplies, paper clips, all of that stuff. We keep very detailed records. I've had a home office since about 1981. We've never been audited. We have very detailed records, though, thanks to my wife, keep it organized. Calculate the share of your home footprint that's business, and use that percentage to deduct from everything: housekeeping services, landscaping, air conditioning, heating, cooling, sewage, homeowner's fees, whatever you have, and deduct that out as part of your home business. Now, I know people will say, well, that messes it all up when I go to sell a house. We've been through three houses, and it hasn't messed up anything. We had no trouble at all. Maybe it was our CPA is really good, but it worked just fine going from selling one house and working it to get to the next. Equipment as a write-off or a depreciation schedule, something I leave up to the accountant, of whether you take it all at once or build it out. But we've got a long depreciation schedule of my wife's photography business and my authoring business. I think that's just one person's opinion of structuring the business, from business cards to the writing studio footprint, the way that's structured and set up, and what many of you have done beyond what I've figured out what to do, and then the business aspect of it, including every time you're driving anywhere to see something related, even obtusely, with your book. You write down the mileage in the logbook. Yeah.
Would you mention that software tool?
You mean what software?
Yeah, TurboTax.
Oh, Marshall do that. Yeah. So that's Robert's just little part of authoring as a business. Now, Marsha's going to talk about what she'll say. You're going to go next. Okay, and then I'll switch over to the thing.
Pardon me? Charles Williams from the University of Florida, and to establish my expertise on this subject, I've served in the dean's office for about over 20 years, and now serve as a graduate coordinator for our department. But since we're in San Antonio, and we talked about Mavericks this morning, Robert. Jim Bowie, you're going to learn a lot about. I'm a descendant of John Bowie, who originally my mother thought was Jim's brother, but my sister later did more research and discovered that it was Jim's father's brother, John Bowie. And John passed through Logan County, Kentucky, and that's where I was born and where Jim Bowie was born. And we found out that Jim Bowie's uncle John was charged with cattle theft in Logan County, Kentucky. So he was a maverick, I suppose. But the bottom line here is that our subject has a little bit to do with, a lot to do with ethics. And as you, I share with you some of the case studies that I've, that really happened, and I was exposed to in the dean's office, you might have similar circumstances. Some of you might have seen this from the Chronicle of Higher Education, what the professor says. Unfortunately, we don't have the time to study all the scholars who have made contributions in this area. And what the professor really means is we will not be covering the work of people whose ideas differ from mine. Or today, we will let members of the class lead the discussion. And what the professor really is saying, I was busy revising a chapter and didn't prepare for class. Or we will be using one of the leading textbooks in the field. And what he really means is we will be using my textbook. So can you see how some of these statements, what the professor really means is a conflict of interest? Here's the first case study I want to share with you. This happened actually when I was in graduate school in Kentucky. A program coordinator who was a master teacher wears a tape recorder to teach class and returns to his office. When returning to his office, he drops off the tape recorder to his secretary to type up the lecture for his forthcoming book. Now, would that fly in your institution today? Okay, case study two. Department chair handwrites chapters of an upcoming book and gives them to his secretary to type so he can mail them to the publisher. You notice a trend here? Most of these are by administrators. case study three. Department chair authors and self-publishes, and this is 30 years ago, publishes a book and requires it for the entire department. So all the faculty had to use that book. This particular former department chair has a nice oceanfront house, as well as a nice two-story mansion in Gainesville, Florida. Here's a more recent one. Senior faculty member submits work order for the college IT staff to assist him in making multimedia presentations to place on a CD to market to students taking his required class. Okay, and this CD is later to has become a national product that's made several, if not millions of dollars. So this is these types of actions have motivated universities to come up with various rules of how to handle conflict of interest and financial interests. And so the University of Florida requires a statement regarding conflict of interest and outside activities and all the letters of hire. This is the sample of a template for a cover letter. And you'll notice that there's nothing in there regarding conflict of interest. You know, it's all the positive stuff about, you know, how many GAs you're going to have, what kind of equipment we're going to buy for you, how much travel money you're going to have, how much money you're going to make. But the actual letter that goes along with it is a quite lengthy document. This is the template or what the dean is supposed to include in the actual letter of contract that the faculty, potential faculty member, signs. And as you know, notice, it's prospective faculty should be told that an employee may not engage in private practice, private consulting, or additional teaching or research which interferes with the full performance of the employee's professional responsibilities, and so on. So if you, depending upon the department chair or the dean who writes that letter, can put a certain slant to it to make one believe that the university owns everything they do, they cannot engage any outside employment. So basically, the conflict of interest, any conflict between the private interests of the employee and the public interests of the University of Florida or the state of Florida, including conflicts of interest specific under Florida statutes or any outside activity or financial interest which interferes with the full and faithful performance of the employee's professional or institutional responsibilities or obligations. So what are the universities afraid of? That last statement gave you a little indication that they don't want you to neglect your duties. So that is probably the primary concern. Nor do they want their resources used for private gain. And they're also concerned about legislators complaining. And they're now concerned about losing university income. And that's primarily because of the Bayh-Dole Act of 1980, in which they decided that academic research is critical to the nation's innovation and research and development capacity. So your College of Engineering, Medicine, Chemistry, and so forth, there was a lot of opportunities for universities to generate income. And that has carried over somewhat into the social science areas as well. So how to protect your book income? Know where to find the information at your institution. You know the rules. You have to understand that different departments actually have different perspectives because of their biases. And I'll get into that in just a moment. If you wish to prevent conflict with your university, follow their guidelines, but make sure you know what those guidelines are. And so some of the sources of information, of course, university rules, Office of Technology Licensing. Do you think they're biased? Collective bargaining agreement. Are they going to be more liberal or more conservative in their view of conflict of interest? So, you know, if I had to go to one document, I'd go to the collective bargaining agreement if I was looking out for my interest. This is a slide from our Office of Technology Licensing talking about the types of intellectual property. Of course, patents, copyrights, know-how. In other words, if you have a protocol on research design, then that's intellectual property. Here's another slide from the Office of Technology Licensing. The UF owns employee inventions when the invention was made while you were employed at UF and the invention is in the field, discipline in which you are or were employed, or the invention was made with university resources. Now, what would that lead you to believe? That would lead you to believe if you did something at home, they own it. Okay, but that's not true. This is another slide from their webpage that shows how they will help you set up a business. They are engaged in startup businesses where the university and the faculty member are owners of that business, and they will help fund that setup. And a little diagram from their webpage to show how it works. And the university, if they conduct a market study and decide that it's not worthwhile, then they can waive their right and give you the copyright or patent or whatever. The university has no interest in it. Or if they are interested, then if it makes less than $500,000, the faculty member can get 40% of that income. So keep that in mind for a future slide. But here's a last case study. Associate Dean and Program Coordinator, with Dean's permission, involved graduate assistants and college IT personnel to develop a series of 14 instructional CDs. College Dean signs contract with National Publishing Company to distribute CDs nationally and required them in the program there at the university. Administrators are paid 40% of net proceeds the university received. The business plan projected net revenue of $60,000. Okay, all this was within the guidelines of the Office of Licensing, and new dean comes in and eliminates the academic program at the University of Florida. Of course, the CDs are selling elsewhere, but certainly the projected net revenue is not met. Another source of information is the guidelines, policies, and procedures handbook put out by the General Counsel's office, and states that faculty members can engage in outside employment consulting and other similar activities. Here's the collective bargaining agreement. Notice the last paragraph there in Article 19. Nothing in this article is intended to discourage an employee from engaging in outside activity in order to increase the employee's professional reputation, service to the community, or income subject to the conditions stated therein, herein. So some types of conflict of interest, time commitments that interfere with duties, use of equipment, personnel, or other university resources, involvement of employees and students supervised and are evaluated by the employee, outside activities with entity that does business with the university, required, this might get some of your attention, required use of books, supplies, or other instructional resources when they're created or published by the employee or by an entity in which the employee has a financial interest. So some guidelines for selection of instructional materials. These are guidelines by the university. Selection must be made for academic reasons and not based on financial gains. Employee may not receive remuneration for materials created exclusively for use in UF courses, so class notes, syllabi, or course packs. You cannot sell legally and receive revenue. If an employee benefits from sale of instructional materials not created exclusively for employees' classroom, then the department chair and dean approve on disclosure form. So our basically our rule at the University of Florida is that if you're going to require a book for your classroom, for your course, then it has to be by a national publisher. Or it has to be, and or you has to be used in more than one university. They do state that instructional materials owned by the University of Florida may financially benefit the employee, department, college, and the university. So conflict may exist even though the activity may provide no remuneration to the faculty members. So if it's interfering with your duties of teaching, advising, what have you, then there's a conflict right there. So who's responsible? Well, it's the faculty member or the staff member. There, the university puts the responsibility on the employee to declare if there's a conflict of interest. Computing resources. This is one statement I found. The computing resources are not to be used for personal commercial purposes or for the personal financial or other gain. You can use them for computers, email, and so forth for your individual use, but not for commercial purposes. Use of email. Any employee engaging in outside activities must recognize that he or she is performing such activities as an individual and may not represent that he or she is acting on behalf of the university. So as Robert, when he started his presentation, shared with you the letterhead and business cards, they do not want you to use university letterhead or business cards. So some suggestions. Know your university rules regarding conflict of interest. Fill out required forms. Report potential conflict of interest. And I passed out a copy of those forms. And the department chair and dean regularly signs those forms, authorizing me to use the computer. So email I use. To correspond, but I have documented that and gotten their permission to use those resources. They're very simple to fill out, and it's minimal uses of university resources. Consider logging in the dates and hours you worked on your book to verify that you didn't do it on so-called company time. Use good ethical judgment when using university resources. Only use university-supplied computer and phone to receive communication from publisher and co-authors. In other words, don't use the university's telephone to make long-distance phone calls. I mean, with cell phones, that's become less of a problem. All right? This is one way administrators are dealing with books. In a new merit evaluation document, the new dean is trying to get passed by the faculty. A book is worth 10 points. One refereed article is worth 40 points. So, all right. Marcia.
Yes, question.
Pardon me?
Administrator wants to become a dean, if the department chair wants to become a dean or become a provost or a president somewhere else, then how many referee publications does that person get to their faculty? It's a good thing that's been a time if they were in. Also, the person is viewing a referee publication as new development of new knowledge, whereas a book is a simulation of existing knowledge. So what's having the most impact upon society? Well, my argument is if I'm having 2 million students a year reading my book, I'm having more impact than 5 people reading referee publication.
Well, I would take issue with one thing that would sort of make a mystery, and that is when I'm dealing with a client who is a university professor, faculty, and I'm dealing with that person as an author, I try to insist that I have their home address, their home fax number, their home email number, and not to use the university at all. When somebody gives me, as an author, email address that ends with an EDU, go away, get out of here. That's not the place to be, because the rules that you're quoting now can change. And when those rules change, that author is going to be exposed. Keep it away from the university 100% of the time.
That would be my suggestion. However, each one of those case studies that I shared with you, under the rules of the university, and if you follow the guidelines, and if your administrators sign off on those documents, all of those could have been made legal. To me, they're unethical, but they could have been made legal under the university rules.
I would like to echo what was said there, too. If any litigation did ever come down the line, the more you have a clear distinction between your authoring work and the professor's status. For example, it says that my collective bargaining agreement is fine for me to use Alan's resources, like a computer in my office for other interests. If, for example, I'm in an office hour and I don't have a student coming in, you know, it's okay to do that. But I never, ever use any of it. I just think it just avoids any
copying. You know, go to a private copy place, make your copy.
Right.
As an author, to what degree would it help me dealing with the university to carry a Bowie knife?
Well, I actually got my first job at a university teaching fencing.
There.
No, actually, not, because we have 15 minutes. Don't
when
we usually
finishes,
get out of 15?
Take the rest of the time.
Yeah, I mean, it's only 15 minutes, right? So at the end, maybe, but I think it'd be selfish, but I'd like to cover my material.
Oh, good.
Whoa. All right. Sorry about that. But hopefully at the end there's time for questions, but I just want to get through my material, if you don't mind. I'm a CPA, and I teach tax and all that, and I was a practitioner for many years, and I still practice. So some of the things, handed them out. Some of the things Robert has talked about, and on some of those things I'm going to reiterate. So anyways, hopefully these goals are the same as what I would consider my goals for a client, to minimize taxes and maximize wealth. And there's a lot of things that can be done to maximize wealth, even if you're not an author. But if that's your goal, then hopefully I can help you with some ideas. Oops. So what I'm going to talk about are some things that Robert might have mentioned, but I'm going to get into some more details, and I can't get in that much detail because of the limit of time, but there are things, if you have a CPA or you want to talk about later, you might think about. Of course, there's the office and the home. I'm going to talk about autos, travel and entertainment, self-employment taxes, entity choice, and retirement, some fringe benefits that you might be able to use. And the entity choice may be something you haven't thought about, meaning should you be a sole proprietorship or should you be a corporation? And then, of course, record keeping. So the home office rules, again, Robert talked about having that separate location. The tax rules, actually, and they're in publication 587, and these PowerPoints will be on the website. So I do give you a lot of publications at the end that you might want to look at. But the important thing is that the home office is to be used exclusively and regularly as a principal place of business or a place to meet clients. Now, if you're an author, of course, that should be your should be your principal place of business. But the words exclusively and regularly are important. That means it can't be part of a dining room. It can't be part of your bedroom. You shouldn't have kids' toys in the home office. Those are sure ways to disqualify the home office. And people, I've dealt with a lot of business owners in the past, and they don't understand that. So do not put those things in your home office. Or if you want to make it questionable, have a TV set in there. You might say, well, I'll watch TV. But especially if you're going to go under, have an audit, move those things out. But I wouldn't recommend having those things in your home office. And a few years ago, there was an additional provision passed by Congress where a principal place of business could also be a place where administrative and management duties are conducted and you have no other fixed location. Now, even as a professor, there have been cases where somebody's been able to take their home office when they did not have an office in the university. There's also a possibility if you're an adjunct professor that you might be able to take a home office if you're not provided a space. But if you have a space in the university, that makes that a lot harder as a professor. But certainly as an author, you could take that home office. But many people, they don't know that. If they're an adjunct, it's possible that you might be able to take a home office. If what?
If the university precludes you from offering on campus.
Oh, no. Having a separate office is not a problem, period, if you're an author. I'm just saying, talking about some people might be adjuncts, and you might not know that you could possibly take a home office. The thing is, the key is that having that separate space. So how much? You know, how much of a home office can you take? Well, it's based on square footage. If you look at the tax form, they're going to ask you the space of your home office, and they're going to ask you the space of your home, okay? And you could have more than one room. Actually, I have two in my home. I have a room I write in, and I actually have a room where I do CPA work. I actually have two home offices for two different purposes, just to make it easier on my mind. I can't do both in the same room. It's kind of odd, but I can't write where I do taxes. It's too taxing. So what can you take? And a portion of your mortgage interest, real estate taxes. If you're a renter, rent, insurance, utilities, repairs. And I'll talk a little bit more about depreciation. The thing is, don't double count. And some people make a mistake. If you're taking some percentage of your mortgage and a percentage of real estate taxes as part of your home office, you cannot also take it on your Schedule A where you itemize. Actually, the IRS programs are sophisticated enough to track that. Years ago, they couldn't, but now they can. The programs actually add up how much interest you're taking in a real estate tax and tie it to your mortgage statement. So you could get a notice. And that's probably happened in the last 5 years. The computer systems are more sophisticated. Now, here, interesting the issue. Robert talked about the sale of the home. Maybe his CPA didn't do this right, or he may not have known. But if you sell your house and you sell at a loss, which is possible today, you can actually deduct that loss on your house on your tax return. And with real estate values going down, this is a good thing. I mean, it's not a good thing to sell at a loss, but if you're trying to redeem this loss, you could actually take a percentage. But the thing you lose, if you sell at a gain, any previously excludable gain is now taxable. And what I mean now, if you sell your home and you're married, you have a $500,000 exclusion on gain on the sale of your home, $250,000 if you're single. Well, according to the IRS, if you have a business portion of your home, that portion's not excluded. So let's say 15% of your home is a business office and you sell your home at a gain. That should be calculated. However, if you're smart enough, and I actually did this with my home office, you can disqualify your home office 2 years before you sell your house if you anticipate a gain, meaning you move the TV set and the kids' toys into your home office. Now you disqualified it. Yes, but it might be worth it. It might be worth it. And I did that. I anticipated selling my house, and I always file on extension anyways, just because I'm like the plumber who doesn't do their own plumbing. I don't do my own taxes till the last minute. So I did disqualify that, and I have advised clients to do that too in the past. If they know they're going to retire, they know they're winding down, I say get rid of the home office. Make it easier. Now, good old automobiles, this is something I get a lot of questions on. Should I lease? Should I buy? How do I write it off? A little more complicated, you might think, and Robert did a good job about talking about the mileage. But if you lease, you would take a percentage of your actual miles, and they ask you for your business miles, your total miles, and they ask commuting, because commuting is not a deduction. Now, the question is your mileage from your home office to another location commuting? It's kind of questionable. Now, I take all my mileage. However, it's a little questionable sometimes, and I'm not going to get into that. Like, if you're a window washer, I've actually read that to your first location, it's considered commuting. So I usually discuss it with clients. There's a little risk factor, but I haven't run into a problem with it. But that's how you figure it out. You could take that if you have a lease. However, if you lease a very expensive car, you have to add income back into your tax return. So when you go to the dealership and they talk to you about leasing, they forget to tell you about this other little issue about adding income back into your tax return depending on the value of your car. Now, if you buy, you could take a percentage of actual expenses or the standard mileage deduction, which most of you might be familiar with, which is 55 cents per mile. And I think I have a little chart. There we go. And what you need to do, now, I'm not this, I'm a CPA and I don't do this, but I'm just going to tell you what the rules are, okay? You should have the date. You should have the purpose. You're supposed to have a beginning odometer reading or an end odometer meeting to get your miles. I generally write my miles down, but I did look this up for this presentation, and this is what you're supposed to have as far as record keeping. Keep it in the glove compartment. So if you really want to protect yourself, and actually tax return asks you if you have written records, and if you say no, that's called a red flag. You don't want to do that. Do you have records, and are they written? So they need to be written. They can't be in your head. Now, something I do, actually, I've told clients before, if you fail to do this, get your credit card bill out and your receipts, and you can reconstruct where you've been and what you've done. And that is, you know, you do have evidence that, yes, I did go to the post office, I did go to the Office Max, I did go to the Kinko's and things like that. But an auditor could deny it and be looking for this. Okay, meals and entertainment quickly. You have to, I don't know if you know this, hopefully you do, but they are limited to 50%. You'll put 100% on your tax return, and then it's reduced by 50%. And if you're taking entertainment, and I'm sure there's some editors, publishers here, or you're taking someone out, you're supposed to have a bona fide business conversation for it to be deductible. Now, it must take place either before, during, or after You don't have to take someone out and just talk to them about business. You can do it before, like a convention. Talk to them before, later, at some point. And we're talking about within a day, if you read, get into some case law. And you're supposed to have the date, place, nature, and duration of the business discussion, identities of those involved. A lot of people don't know about duration, like you're going to be timing it. But, you know, if you talk about business 15 minutes, write it down. Yeah, take notes. Okay, where do you report this stuff? Now, it's also very important that you're in business to make a profit. You could run into problems if authoring is a hobby. Because if authoring is a hobby, you have to report your income, and then you're only allowed to take your expenses as an itemized deduction, reduced by what we call 2% adjusted gross income. Not a good position, and you can't take losses. However, starting up as an author, you can take losses if you're a business. How are you a business? Well, you have to be in business to, at some point, make a profit. The rules, there's something called the presumptive rule of Code Section 183, which says, maybe it's 153, but that you need to make profit 3 out of 5 years. Now, they look at a history. Maybe you don't make profit for 3 years, and then your book starts making money. That's generally okay. But if it's a hobby, you're going to run into some problems. Losses are not allowed. Okay? Now, the other thing is, if you are making a profit, you report your income on Schedule C if you're a sole proprietor, not Schedule E. Schedule E mentions royalties, but it's not talking about book royalties. They go on Schedule C. And your net, you owe self-employment tax, which is your Social Security and Medicare. And the catch is, when you're an employee, you pay half, and your employer pays half. But if you're self-employed, you pay all. Both sides, the employer and employee portion, and let's see, I'm doing it. Okay. And that can be costly, and you need to keep that in mind, okay, that you've got to pay this extra portion. Unless you're making so much money at the university, you're over some of the limits and things, but in general. Now, here's another idea. Or you could open an S Corp and pay yourself a W-2. And in this case, losses are allowed. It's a little complicated, but actually my authorship, I've always run it through an S-Corp, and I'll explain some reasons why. Because when it comes to entity choice, the idea is to maybe shelter some of your income. I teach, and then I make money. I've made money being an author. So I want to shelter the money. I don't need that money to live on, and I don't make a lot. I've just made a little bit because my books haven't been big bestsellers, you know, CPA stuff for restaurant owners. That's what I've done. So, but I shelter it. And I found I could shelter more by having a S corporation because I have a simple IRA. And I can put money away, maximize my retirement, what I could put away, which is $11,500. And if you're over 50, you can put some extra money in. That worked for me and some of my clients. But depending on what kind of retirement plans you might be in, let's say you're teaching, these are all have limits if you end up teaching. But you can take an IRA deduction, which is limited to $5,000. If you make good money, you might want to have a SEP Keel plan where you can put up to 25%, up to $49,000. So if you're making a lot of money, this might be the preference. Or a 401k. And a solo plan where this is the maximum individual contribution, but the employer can put money away. And I forgot to put that limit down, or what we call the simple IRA. Then there's other tax shelters, educational savings accounts for your $2,000 for each child under 19, but there's an income limit. Then the health savings account, $2,900 for an individual, $5,800 for a family. Now, one other thing about S-Corps, there's something called a fringe, working condition fringe benefit. And what that is a working condition fringe benefit is if you could deduct something as an employee business expense as being an employee of a corporation, then the corporation can give you that money. And you can actually hide your office in the home. The IRS will never know that you're being reimbursed for it unless they audit you. And corporations' audit rates are much lower than sole proprietors. Sole proprietorship could be 5%, where S-Corp is like 1/50th of 1%. as well as your corporation can reimburse you for your mileage, and it's not even seen. So a lot of my small-owned clients are S-Corps for this reason, because I'm trying to prevent audits, not there to try to hide anything, but I've gone through audits with clients where they've lasted 2 days, and they're a major inconvenience and very stressful. But the only problem is with that is higher tax prep fees. If you have W-2s and you're issuing them yourselves, you're going to have to probably pay somebody to do that. Here's a little list of tax guides. And you can get those off the website, business use of the home, business use of vehicles. Have you ever looked, the IRS likes to put time down, like how long it takes to read these documents. Have you ever seen this, how long it takes to do these tax forms? And it's like 100 hours to do one little form. So, you know, for those that are very thorough, you might want to look some things up, or some of this information I got right out of those those particular tax guides. So now we can entertain questions for everyone. I know that's a lot and it's a little complicated, but thanks.
Let me answer your question of what is your time. Back when I was an administrator, my answer would have been the university owned you 24/7. However, that's not it. The university, as long as you get your responsibilities completed in a satisfactory manner, then that's all the university has the right to request. So if you can get, if you're teaching two classes and you're advising X number of students or interns and you're writing at the level that the university, they're not going, or they shouldn't ask or have a problem with you consulting and doing other outside activities. No ties.
So on the flip side, if you're in a location that is marketable, for example, I'm a senior designer at the university, as long as I'm getting my degree at the university, they love the fact that I design professionally, and under my bio it says Scott Boyd, Professor of Wilson State University, .. It is free publicity for them. And as long as you've got a good relationship with your administrators, they're more than happy to allow me to use office computers and resources for other non-expensive.
And I think the key word there, or phrase, is as long as you have good relations with your administrators. And that could change next month or next year with a new administrator. The one area that the University of Florida will not go after is royalties on books. They have stayed away from that as much as possible. But again, I agree with your statement, you know, stay away as much as possible from using university resources. I have never told anyone at the university how much money I make from publishing. I have talked to them about how many people utilize my books, and let you know if they wanted to do the math, they could. But when I was on 12-month contract, if I went out to consult for the publisher, I would take annual leave. I would never take university work pay and consulting pay on the same day. One more question.
Well, he's asking, is there a minimum level where you might consider incorporating? No, I don't have a minimum level. I mean, even if you're making $12,000 and you have other pay, yeah, incorporate, put, shelter all of it, absolutely, because that's what you could do. Yeah.
But on that same point, when you're dealing with a publisher, if you start out as an individual and then go to incorporate, now you got a contract with you as an individual. So my advice, my response to your question would be, no, incorporate before you even publish.
Yeah. And you wouldn't necessarily, I don't always use my corporation, but you have the option there, and it's not costly to open a corp. And then you can use the vehicle when it works. The Fed government doesn't require annual filing, but the state might require something, so you might get some advice on that. Yes?
Is there any way that you can deduct charitable deductions from your business or your S-corp?
Yes. It depends what kind of corp. If your S-corp, it flows through, so it doesn't really matter. It flows through as a personal expense. If you're C-corp, the rules are different, but I would not probably recommend a C-corporation. I would recommend S-corporation. Okay. Thanks.
This has been an educational presentation brought to you by the Text and Academic Authors Association.